Welcome to Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs, the podcast for busy and high-performing entrepreneurs and leaders who are looking to create more energy and optimize their health while upgrading their brain and personal performance with precision. I am your host, Julian Hayes II. I've been involved with health and performance for over a decade. This podcast was created for the high performer who is unapologetically ambitious, the one who moves at a fast pace and operates with an edge, the one who wants to become superhuman. Nothing here is fluff, gimmicky, or feel good. I have little to no interest in simply helping you improve your life. I want to help transform it. By listening to this podcast, expect to have a body that feels just as good as it looks. Expect to possess a swagger and style that gives off an infectious vibe. Expect to command the stage or any boardroom you walk into with your executive presence. And lastly, expect to become your most enhanced self so you can live a limitless life. Now, let's get to the show. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Optimal Health for Busy Entrepreneurs. I am your host, Julian Hayes II, and I'm here with an awesome guest, Florence Williams. And she is a journalist, author, podcaster. She's a contributing editor at Outside Magazine, a freelance writer for the New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, New York Review of Books, Slate, Mother Jones, and numerous other publications. She is very prolific. And she is the writer and host of two Gracie Award-winning Audible original series, Breasts Unbound and The 3-Day Effect, as well as Outside Magazine's Double X Factor podcast. Her public speaking includes keynotes at Google, the Smithsonian, the Seattle Zoo, the Aspen Ideas Festival, and many other corporate, academic, and nonprofit venues. So without further ado, Florence, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Julian. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm excited to talk about nature because it's something that probably a lot of listeners are kind of like me. They're more, they call themselves city boys, city girls, and they don't really know the real benefits of nature. So I'm excited to introduce this idea to them. And so without further ado, though, let's start going to your past. So I always love to ask this question. What are one to two lessons from childhood that shaped you into who you are today?
Oh, boy. Good question. Well, I guess I can sort of tie into what you were saying about being a city boy, because I actually grew up in New York City. I grew up in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, and my parents were divorced. My mother hated camping, but my dad was kind of a wilderness guy. And so I would say that, you know, one of the factors that shaped me was that he used to sort of drag me out of the city to go hiking and canoeing and, you know, jumping into streams and stuff like that. And I think that had a huge influence on me. But I would say also that my mom, even though she hated camping, she really loved art and culture. And, you know, so I would go to museums with her. So I feel like I am really, I used to be very confused about those two strains in myself that, you know, I had to pick one or something. And at some point it occurred to me that, no, you actually don't have to pick one. You can be both.
Yeah. I lived in New York for a year during grad school, and Central Park became my favorite place to hang out at. I didn't expect that going into it, but something about it was very restorative for me.
It's Central Park is probably my favorite place in the universe, which is really weird because I've been to a lot of very beautiful places, but I love it too.
What do you love about Central Park?
Oh, well, you know, Frederick Law Olmsted, I think, was a genius, and he really knew what he was doing as early as like 1864. He just believed that being in nature could restore you mentally. When you were tired, it could sort of recharge your cognitive batteries and your emotional batteries. Somehow he just knew that and he wrote about it. And he was also an artist. So he understood this concept of, you know, having trees intermingled with pasture, intermingled with cultivated flower beds, intermingled with like interesting architectural bridges. Evolutionary biologists talk about how humans like both shelter and the ability to see vistas. They call it prospect and refuge, you know, and Olmsted just understood that. So when you go into Central Park, like you see the trees, you feel sort of sheltered by them, but you also have these beautiful views. You can see past down the meadows, I just think intuitively he was a genius. And I think that's why we feel so good in Central Park.
Yeah. And that makes me think, for me, I just felt an energy there, especially when we were coming out of winter and heading right into the beginning of spring. And it's just like everyone's unthawing and people are congregating. They're just happy to be outside. It's such an energetic place. I miss it.
I love it too that you, like you said, you see other people, that there's this sense that you're part of a collective, you know, and not just bobbing by yourself through space, you know, that you're sort of tied and tethered to other people who also value these things. And that's something that nature provides that I think is kind of underappreciated, that it's a space, you know, in which to be with people who aren't necessarily like you and who make you sort of appreciate, you know, the fact that we live in a democracy, that we're all here together, that we can get along sometimes, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
So when you were writing your book, what is something that just shocked you that you learned when you're writing The Nature Fix?
Well, I wrote The Nature Fix because I already believed, you know, in my heart and soul that nature made me feel better when I was in it. And also I got my best ideas when I was out for walks in nature. So I understood the sort of creative part and the recharge part. But I think some of the things that really surprised me about the book were having to do with how being in nature actually makes us better people in a civilization. So that when we experience something beautiful, we actually feel like we're connected to something larger than ourselves. And when we feel that way, we are less selfish, we're less egotistical, we are more generous. And this has been shown in various laboratory studies, you know, that psychologists will show people photographs of, like, you know, a shopping mall or a freeway. And then they'll show people photographs of like a whale jumping or a waterfall. And they'll give them these games. They'll have them play games. And the people who look at the beautiful photographs are the ones who perform better on teams. They give away more money to causes. Like, they're just nicer people. And I think it gets to this idea of, again, just feeling connected to something outside of your own crazy brain. It's so important for us not to just be sucked into the soundtrack of our own minds. And nature just really helps pull us out of that.
Yeah. So we need to build like a city. And, you know, I guess that's the difficulty, because I think more and more trees are being cut down, it seems, and more just cities are being built up. Is that a fair assessment? It seems that nature,
you know,
is not.
It depends. Honestly, Julian, it depends where you look. I think that there's always pressure from development, and certainly many, many beautiful suburban wetlands and forests have been cut down to make way for developments. But within cities themselves right now, there are a number of campaigns in places like New York and LA and Louisville, I mean, all over, to plant trees. And so we see these fantastic tree planting campaigns. There are actually more trees in some of these cities now than there were, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. It is hard to keep some of these trees alive, but there's a lot of urgency to it now, especially because of global warming and the urban heat island effect. So where there are trees and grass, we know that temperatures are more moderated. And we also know that there's more evidence that people are healthier and happier when they're looking at greenery. So we actually are seeing some of these ideas seep into urban areas, and I'm super excited about that.
The concept of an urban health penalty, that was very interesting to me. I don't think listeners probably never heard of that. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I mean, modern cities today are filled with noise pollution. They're filled with air pollution, traffic, expense, you know, a lot of overstimulation and, you know, crowds, basically. So we know that people who live in these urban areas, even though they may love them and they may really like love the vibe and love the culture and love the energy, it sort of takes a toll on your mental health by the end of the day, where you feel a little bit depleted, you feel tired because you've been sort of filtering out all this noise and traffic. So the urban health penalty is this just sort of very clear evidence showing that people are more likely to have anxiety, more likely to have schizophrenia when they grow up in urban environments or live in urban environments. And then I get really into the noise and air pollution stuff, where we know that both of these things increase your risk factors for things like cardiovascular disease, for stroke. People need more anxiety meds when they live under the flight paths of large urban airports. Learning rates and reading abilities go down in schools, you know, that are really, really noisy. And this is, you know, once you've already adjusted for socioeconomic factors. So I think the pollution thing is real and it takes a toll.
Interesting. I wouldn't even think that it had that much effect on our cognition.
It's very subconscious, right? It's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard. We don't feel our reading levels declining, but in fact, it just requires so much mental resource to sort of block out sound. And it creates these like micro stresses that make learning more difficult.
So I guess when we think about sound, and we talked a little bit before we started recording that when I was staying when I was in Portugal, I lived right by the river in Porto, and there was the sound of the water was relaxing to me, but my brain waves were probably changing as well. Is that something that you're talking about as well? So like the sound of water, maybe even more birds chirping, is that positively and cognitively helping us?
Yeah, actually it really is. So according to the science, there are three sounds that the human brain really responds to very positively. Well, beyond the sound of, you know, your loved ones, maybe, and your children laughing, things like that. But three ambient sounds. And those are the sound of water and the sound of birdsong and the sound of wind, like not terrifying hurricane wind, but just like gentle breezes. There's something about hearing those things that makes us subconsciously feel like the world is moving along the way it's supposed to be moving along. You know, the birds are singing. That means something is right in the world. It sets us at ease, you know, our nervous systems on this very just deep, evolved, you know, subconscious level.
And so when we think about, I guess some people will say, I guess if I'm going to be put my skeptic hat on right now, what if some people will say, I'm not living close to a lot of nature right now. So I guess, actually, I think even better is when we think about nature, when you talk about nature, what do you consider just nature? Because a lot of times I just think of just hiking or something.
I think that is a really, really interesting and even profound question, because how we identify nature, how we define it, the words we use, they can really alienate us. You know, they can sort of create obstacles in our brains. I believe in a really generous definition of nature. And in fact, Oscar Wilde had this, his definition of nature was any place birds are flying around uncooked.
Oh, okay.
you know, if you ask a kid what's nature, the kid will say, oh, you know, there's a tree on my street and I saw a caterpillar on the sidewalk and there's a really pretty pine cone over here. If you ask an adult what nature is, they'll often say, oh, it's Yosemite. You know, it's a national park. It's an unpeopled mountain meadow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a dramatic waterfall. And of course, that means that we are even further cutting ourselves off from nature. We're not considering ourselves a part of nature. I think that these have real consequences for how we interact with the natural world. And I think that's unfortunate. I would like us to all go back to the child's definition, where we're able to see and recognize beauty, you know, in the world around us. And certainly a lot of cities, you know, all cities have nature in them. It's just sort of a question of how you find them, who has access to that nature, and how do you create more access?
So what are some of the biggest reasons that you, what are your nature skeptics? What do you see are some of the biggest draws to get them to appreciate nature more and get out there more?
Yeah, I think a lot of people just say, oh, nature's not for me because I define it, you know, as something, you know, that people like me don't go to, or that's too hard to get to, or I don't have time for it. So I think that's a big impediment. I think that right now we are living, you know, in the midst of sort of this unmatched disconnection from the natural world. I mean, never has our species lived so far removed from kind of, real nature and spent so much time indoors. And I think that obviously has enormous consequences for how comfortable we feel going outside, how we can identify with people who go outside. We think that we're going to feel better watching television, being inside air conditioning, you know, feeling kind of safe and protected and not having to deal with rain or discomforts of being outside. But actually, that's a huge fallacy, right? Because so many of our chronic epidemics of diseases that we see are from living too much time indoors, from spending too much time indoors. It's, you know, obesity, it's anxiety, it's depression, it's, you know, a lack of vitamin D, lack of fresh air, lack of exercise. The irony is we'd actually be more comfortable in our bodies if our bodies were used the way evolution has designed them to be used, which is this full sensory way. Like if we can actually, you know, feel the wind on our cheeks and hear the bird song and have our bodies adjust to sort of different temperatures, it's actually really great for our immune systems. It's great for our mental health. And it's great for our emotional outlook.
And so in the 3-day effect, which was very entertaining, by the way, is it 3 days? Why was it 3 days in nature?
Well, the 3-day effect is an audio program that we made. It's kind of like a 6-part podcast. And what we did was we took one section of my book, mm-hmm. because in the book, I structure it by dose. So first I start talking about sort of nearby nature, the benefits that have been kind of documented by living, you know, in neighborhoods that have more trees, by having kids have recess and go to schoolyards. And then these sort of more deliberate visits to natural areas, what happens to your immune system. And then the last part of the book is really what happens to your brains and your bodies when you're out in the wilds for 3 days. And the term has been, the 3-day effect has really been popularized by this neuroscientist who I spend a lot of time with in Utah. He found that he got his best ideas after being, you know, on a river trip or walking in the desert for 3 days. And he started doing studies to find out why that was. And what he came to sort of conclude, and he's still sort of working on actually showing the biomarkers for this, is that our thinking brains kind of dial down when we're outside as our sensory brains wake up, right? So there's this sort of change in our blood flow and in our brainwave patterns when we are really mindful of these beautiful spaces that we're in, and we're seeing things we didn't see when we first got there. We're hearing things we didn't hear. Our sensory brains just come alive after a few days outside. And our thinking brains take this little break. And then when we go back to work or go back to school after 3 days, like all of a sudden we're just so much sharper because we've kind of rested our prefrontal cortex, you know, almost like a muscle. Mm-hmm. So that's what we were looking at with that podcast.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you had soldiers, and then you also had the sex trafficking on there as well. And there's really no profession, no matter what, that could really benefit from doing something like that.
Well, what we were looking at was trauma. Mm-hmm. You know, how being outside for extended periods of time is actually incredibly powerful for healing trauma and grief. You know, going for like 15-minute walks isn't necessarily going to help you with that. Like having the time and the space to sort of calm your nervous system down, again, sort of wake up those senses that maybe you've been deliberately shutting off because of trauma and hypervigilance. It was really powerful for me to watch the veterans, you know, watch these sort of trafficking survivors, you know, start to just come alive again in a way that they hadn't felt in a long time. And so many of the ways that we treat post-traumatic stress just aren't that effective. You know, it's really, really hard to treat it. The medications have a lot of side effects. Therapy is really helpful, but it requires a lot of dedication and commitment, and a lot of people have trouble sort of staying in it. And it just turns out that like spending time in nature can actually help complement those other therapies, as well as kind of building social bonds with other people who are going through what you're going through. And again, sort of like resetting your nervous system in this way that is really, really helpful for then healing.
And so that reminds me of the forest bathing.
Yeah.
In Japan, right? And was it 15 minutes? Was that the dose there?
the first places I went for the book because there was a sort of ongoing science happening there. And researchers were studying people's heart rates, their blood pressure, their heart rate variability, their stress hormones. And it was kind of amazing what they were finding, which is that just after, 15 minutes of walking around a forest in Japan, they call it forest bathing. Mm-hmm. And it is a sort of specific set of practices that really just helps people take deep breaths and sort of pay attention to what they're smelling and hearing. So it's a very sort of grounding, almost meditative practice outside. But just after 15 minutes of that, they were seeing this like 16% drop in stress hormones, a 4% drop in blood pressure, kind of a slowing of respiration, all indicating that, their nervous system was changing in a way that created a lot less stress, more healthful sort of milieu for fighting disease, boosting your immune system, stuff like that. And then, if you look at these large epidemiological studies, you see that the people who are spending more time in nature or who just live closer to green spaces actually do have fewer diseases and they live longer. And this is after adjusting even for income and education.
So could it be worth it? Say someone, they live in a residential neighborhood where there's not really any trees, but there's a nearby park, maybe 10 minutes away. A 15-minute walk at the park compared to the residential neighborhood. Will there be more benefit just walking in that park?
According to that Japanese research, it's pretty mm-hmm. clear. It's pretty clear because they also sent groups of people to walk the same distance mm-hmm. in the urban areas. So it wasn't just an exercise effect, that they were seeing. It was only really the people who were walking in these natural areas that had this big boost in mood, in feelings of well-being, in their cardiovascular systems, changing. And then there are other studies, that's 15 minutes, but there's been some other really interesting brain studies looking at people who walk for 90 minutes in a park mm-hmm. Versus 90 minutes in an urban area. And they see this pretty interesting change in brain wave patterns and activation of the brain that's tied to preventing depression. And so that's really interesting. And the Finnish researchers found something similar where they say that people can actually prevent mild depression by spending, about 30 to 40 minutes in a natural area twice a week.
Wow. So this is, I guess, the type A in me now. Could I, if I run, because I'm thinking, okay, maybe I should include the park more on my route that I run. Is there a dose for runners? Could I like maybe half that, you think, instead? I don't even know if that's been studied.
I don't know if that's been studied, Julian. You'll have to. Here's what I tell people. Try it.
Yeah.
And then but here's the thing. You can't just try it. You have to actually pay attention mm-hmm. to your body, which it's funny, but we haven't really been taught to do that. And we don't. We sort of like just move on really fast, or we think about our to-do lists or whatever when we're out there. But if you take your earbuds out, think about really engaging all of your senses. Okay. So when you're on your run, be like, hey, do I hear any birds? Like, what patterns can I see in the trees? Like, what's the grass doing over there? Like you have to sort of cue yourself into the present moment and not just like, space out with your podcast that you're listening to or whatever. If you do that, and then at the end of your run go, how do I feel? Do I feel sort of more invigorated? Do I feel more relaxed? Try it.
Yeah, because I do already know that the difference between running in a treadmill at the gym compared to running outside, it's night and day. It's much more enjoyable to run outside than a treadmill for me.
Interesting. And do you feel like you're in a better mood after being outside?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's one. I wasn't really into running a lot, but I'm really addicted to it now because since the lockdown started, I've just ran more. And
so here's what you should do. You should try running in the park and then try running, not in the park mm-hmm. and like do this for a couple of weeks and check in with yourself and see how you feel. Because, according to the science, you probably will feel a little bit more emotionally restored, mm-hmm. And de-stressed in the park. But this is also really interesting compared to working out on a treadmill for some reason. And I can't really figure out why, but people seem to get a better workout when they're in the real world as compared to in the treadmill, on a treadmill?
Yeah, I think it's something about the way the treadmill is structured, and you're just standing in one place at a time. And then some people, it kind of throws off their natural gait as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. So I think those are factors as well. But you gave me some homework to do.
Okay, I want you to let me know how it goes.
And so I'm thinking there's listeners out there, and they're probably a little bit like me. They like to quantify everything. So is there like a time limit that you think would be recommended to aim for in a week of being out in nature?
That is a great question. It kind of gets to this dose question. And there are a number of scientists who have been looking at this. I mean, basically, I think, look, you know, there's so much human variability. There are some, I think that there are some times in your life when you're more stressed out, like, hey, when there's a pandemic, mm-hmm. when you actually might need more time outside looking at things that are beautiful to calm you down. You know, when you're going through a difficult time, you know, just personally, or when you've had a, you know, a fight with someone you care about or whatever, there are just times in your life when you're going to need nature more than other times. But in terms of the studies, what they've shown in Finland, they've shown that you really need a minimum of 5 hours a month to prevent depression. And that's that, like, you know, twice a week, 30 to 40 minutes. A study in the UK found that the people who got a little bit more than that, 8 hours a month, so that's 2 hours a week, the people who were outside for 2 hours a week, and it didn't matter if it was all in one day or spread out over the week, those were the people who were the happiest and the healthiest by a lot. It was like this big sweet spot. If you go 2 hours a week, you are looking really good. If you got like 4 hours a week, there actually was not a big difference.
Okay. So it's kind of like exercise is good, but there's always that J curve eventually.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like the secret sauce was that 2 hours a week mm-hmm. in the UK anyway.
That's manageable too. 2 hours.
It is manageable.
It's very manageable. I was expecting a lot more, and I'm sure some of the listeners were as well. That's easy.
And the other thing is, you know, the studies show that you are actually more productive and more creative. So it's not like you're losing good work time. You're actually mm-hmm. maybe creating more efficient work time if you're more awake and you're smarter and you're in a better mood when you come back from it. You can actually get more done.
Yeah. And I think from Beethoven to Charles Dickens to, I think there's a lot of other people who did these long walks.
There are a lot of people who did long walks. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of these are out in nature as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nikola Tesla, you know, he invented his revolutionary engine after a walk in the park. The guy who invented like the cotton gin, that was after a walk in the park. Yeah. Beethoven used to literally like hug trees in his backyard. I mean, I could go on and on. You know, Wordsworth wrote thousands of lines of poetry while walking thousands of miles, you know, across England and across the Alps. You know, Jane Austen's characters, you know, even the women went for walks on the fens, because that was one of the few places where women could actually like be, you know, alone and sort of do something they wanted to do that was like outside the expectations and confines of domestic living. Right. So walking has always been associated with a kind of almost radical, revolutionary, sort of free thinking space. And, you know, you see it with protests today, you see it with marches. There's something about walking that is, you know, sort of politically powerful as well as psychologically powerful.
Yeah. And it's almost like a thing in life where the most simplest things we just take for granted and overlooked. And yeah. They can be some of the most powerful things to really better our lives.
That's right. Walking. Yeah. I mean, we have these legs, you know, and we should use them.
So what's your daily and weekly routine when it comes to getting your nature dose in? What do you do?
Yeah, thanks for asking. And it's actually changed a little bit during the pandemic. I've heard that for a lot of people, it has as well, that people are getting outside more. Well, of course, mm-hmm. it's like the only thing we can do really is we can't have a lot of social interaction or a lot of the fun stuff we used to do. So a lot of people are going out more. For me, I've been doing this new ritual where I walk to a place down my block. I live in the heart of Washington, D.C., so I'm in a city, but I can walk about 5 blocks to a place where I can see the sunset. And I've been doing that most nights. I also go for walks where I can see the moon and I see what phase the moon is in. You know, no matter where you live, you can always look up. right? Even in the densest city, you can sort of pay attention to what the moon's doing. You can see the clouds. Even that, you can have these brief moments of awe and beauty that the science tells us are actually really, really important for our well-being.
Interesting. Yeah. So yeah, you're really encouraging me to be more perceptive of my environment and just look up.
Just look up and say, you don't have to climb a mountain, Julian. Yeah. Just like, even, oh, the other thing I recommend that people do to sort of start out is just eating a meal or drinking a cup of coffee outside. You know, sit outside somewhere where, you know, you can feel the weather. Maybe you can hear some birds. You know, the science shows us actually that we digest food a little bit better when we're outside. And it's probably because our nervous system does feel a little bit calmer out there.
And so, so now as we start to wrap this up, we're going to do kind of a, I used to call it a rapid fire, but it's not really a rapid fire. So it's more like just random questions. So the first one is, what are maybe 2 to 3 books that have had a major impact on your life?
I love The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. It's really about sort of the good in humanity. And I read that when I was a teenager, when I was feeling very cynical about humanity. And I think that had a huge impact on me. I love reading Michael Pollan's books for how they incorporate sort of science and first person writing, which is something that I do. I guess I would just throw out there. Yeah. How about like George Eliot's Middlemarch?
Okay.
There you go.
And, I think this is just a personal question that I'm curious about. What's your creative process like? How do you, like when you're forming articles, and what's your creative process like?
Ooh, good question. I keep a journal. And I try to write down things. I have notes files in my phones. I try to write down things that sort of catch my fancy, you know, like good quotes or a thought that I might have, or like some cool photo or a story idea. I try to write them down because I'm like at the age now where I'll forget them if I don't write them down. And then when I'm writing a book, I try to write a little bit every day, but it doesn't always happen. I also try to be sort of forgiving because I think that's important. I mean, I'm a mom, you know, life happens. And then I prioritize sleep, because without sleep, there is no creativity. That's my lesson.
Very much so. Very much so. I learned very much so.
You've noticed that too.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. And that's usually the clients I deal with, because they're pretty high charging people, that that's usually the chokehold. You know, exercise is fine, but they'll try to skip on sleep and stuff. And so luckily you got technology now, and you can kind of show, this is what your brain does on this amount of sleep, and this is what it does on optimal sleep and that kind of stuff. So
exactly. I think one of the things I've learned is that a little bit of stress is fine. Mm-hmm. You know, we need it. Actually, it's really motivating. It's great to have a deadline. It's great to have a little bit of adrenaline. The trick is that we need to get better at recovering from it. Mm-hmm. And then once you do that, I think, you know, the stress can be really productive and not damaging.
What's one big lesson or takeaway that you've kind of learned throughout the pandemic during the last, I think it's been like 10 months?
Yeah, I think it's that that we are valuing more on the things that really make us human. And we're thinking more about that. So, you know, it's our relationships, it's our connection to each other, and it's a connection to the natural world. You know, that these are actually the things that matter, mm-hmm. and that we can survive, you know, without going to really trendy restaurants. I mean, it's sad. I miss them, but you know, I think we sort of come back to this elemental piece of it. And I also think that because of these things are important, because nature is important, because connection to people is important, we also really need to think about how to redesign our cities to sort of strengthen those connections.
That's a category of books that I've been meaning to get into, is just city designing. Just I want to read about how New York, I forgot the author. I think there's a really good book out there about how New York was designed and everything, but I forgot the name of it.
We need to make our living spaces humane, you know, mm-hmm. without it, it's just a really lost opportunity and putting us at risk for all kinds of mental health problems.
And the next question is, say, who is in your all-time musical starting five? And it can be groups, solo artists, a combination, and they can be dead or alive. It doesn't matter.
Oh my God. Well, I've been listening to Chopin lately.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm into the Mozart piano sonatas. I'm into piano right now. You know, getting a little more recent, I really, let's see. I don't know. You're making me draw a blank. should I go back to the 17th century?
Let's go wherever. I think one of my favorite songs is Jules Massenet. It's the Meditations.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite songs. I was the story behind that is that I was really struggling. I was just starting my business and everything, and there's a free concert at the public library. And there's this lady playing this song, and I just fell in love with it. And so I asked the people beside me, I was like, what is it? What is this song? And
you'll have to link to that in your story notes. So now going back even farther in time, you're reminding me in terms of meditation, the 12th century mystic, Hildegard von Bingen, mm-hmm. she has these incredible chants that I've also been listening to some this year that have been really fun.
And so the next question is, the last question I have to say is going to be, pretend you have a bunch of tea or coffee or water or wine. You have all the choices there. And it's a roundtable discussion. And you can invite three people to sit with you. And they can be dead or alive, but it has to exclude family. So who would you invite for this conversation?
Oh, wow. Maybe George Eliot. So she wrote Middlemarch. So one of my favorites. Maybe Toni Morrison, because I love her storytelling and I love her voice. And I wouldn't mind having a beer with Barack Obama. That'd be kind of mm-hmm. cool.
So all great storytellers.
Yeah.
And your books has storytelling.
Yeah.
All your work does storytelling. So that's kind of reflective of who you are.
Definitely. Tell me stories and then we know how to live.
Yeah. So, I mean, this question is undefeated. Every time I ask this, it really reflects who the person I'm talking to is by the people that they choose to have the roundtable with.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So, but also people who are really humane, mm-hmm. you know, that have taught us how to get along with each other and how to love, you know, that's really what it comes down to.
And where can listeners keep up with you for any future projects that you have going on?
Thanks for asking. I post a lot of stuff to Instagram, which is Florence999. And my website is florencewilliams.com. And you can sign up for my newsletter and find out my latest work there.
All right. And I will have all that in the show notes. And Florence, thank you so much for this conversation. Definitely go check out the book. Check out the podcast as well. They are fantastic.
Oh, thanks, Julian. It's been a pleasure. Now go outside and find some trees.
All right, everyone. Stay awesome, be limitless, and go be superhuman.